multiple intelligences are necessary just to get around in life. You have to be able to move your legs and read and write and think, talk, reflect perhaps, do whatever it is that you do. To play a piano, you need physical and mental and some would say emotional and intellectual intelligences. And most pianists who have some success have those things, but sometimes they don't let us know too much about them, particularly in the pre-internet age. We might know that a pianist happens to collect something or be a mean bridge player or something like that, but many of them never did and some still don't give interviews. Radu Lupu, Maurizio Pollini very rarely. But Jeremy Dank not only plays the piano very well, but he also writes his own program notes and gives interviews and has a blog and writes articles for The New Yorker and other places. How do you do all that?
I have no idea. I mean, writing has always been a kind of a second thing that I do to escape from the mania of playing the piano. So
it is something that sort of takes another half or another side of you. It's not something that's just coming right, oh, I've just played this, now I wish to extemporize upon it.
Well, I mean, playing the piano is a very solitary activity, and inevitably you're there practicing and these thoughts kind of come to you over mm-hmm. a long. There's nowhere to really share them or let them out. So in a way, the writing does sort of emerge from the practicing, but in a way, it's a completely different kind of discipline and different kind of...
Jeremy Dank was pointing to either a part or a cross-section of his head
right.
when he said that.
Yes, to get out of one corner of it and into another, I guess.
You also studied chemistry. Was that another part of your brain, or is that really what the piano and writing are all about?
I would say I'm not necessarily a failed chemist, but what's the word when you've escaped from something? I've renounced it. I've renounced my chemistry citizenship. Even when I was at Oberlin, I sort of about midway through, I realized I wasn't wanting to.
Why had you elected that along with piano in the first place?
Well, you know, I was like, I went to...
You heard the Tom Lehrer song. You had memorized all the elements and
oh, yeah.
it was time.
No, I didn't know that song at
oh,
that time.
Really?
I don't remember knowing
These
it
are anything. The only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. There probably are some others, but they haven't been discovered. This is after he sings them all
right,
from
right,
hydrogen
right.
on.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway.
I went to college a little young. And I was a very academically curious, active. I did everything in high school and junior high.
Where were high school and junior high?
In Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Okay.
Odd place for a classical musician to come from. But I was out there, and I don't know. I was good at chemistry. I was good at math. I was a real math and science kid. But I was also very, very active in my English classes. So it was all over the map. And I had a hard time renouncing that side of me when I went to college. That's why I went to Oberlin, so I could
right.
do both.
Yeah. So you could be the college and the conservatory.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But you seem to have survived all of these renouncements and emphases shifts or whatever.
Yeah, well, it was very natural. I mean, the great thing about being able to do that at Oberlin is that you're there in college, you're doing all these things at a collegiate level, and then you realize, you know, at some point it speaks to you, you realize that
right.
one direction or another. And it was very happy and kind of easy thing for me. I mean, a little stress in terms of, you know, should I quit? I actually didn't quit the chemistry degree. I finished it out.
Right.
And then switching, you know, just focusing on the piano was very easy because I was, you know, I went to school with this other teacher in Bloomington and I followed him and I was working and trying to grow and all that kind
right.
of stuff.
So you seem to have found, at least for now, a way to take your curiosity, which extends beyond the piano, although it's very deep in terms of the piano and the repertoire, and your enthusiasm, and bring them together into this combination of activities.
All hail the internet, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, because it's hard to imagine how, I mean, the sort of things that I was writing or have been writing on the blog for now, 7 years, 6 years,
mm-hmm.
you could never really put in a I mean, sometimes bits of it you can put in a program note, but mostly it wouldn't fit there, right? It's too long and involved and too snarky for a mm-hmm. pre-concert lecture, you know. Mm-hmm. It won't go into a, you know, a newspaper interview or a puff piece, or right. It doesn't fit in any of the, but somehow, you know, I got lucky and a few people were started reading it and it passed around via word of mouth, and I was able, now I'm able to write, you know, sort of these uncategorizable pieces.
Do you feel pressure to keep up? Do the followers of Think Dank want to know when's the next entry? And
that is a drag. And especially, I mean, inevitably, if you have a piece published in The New Yorker, you suddenly have a certain daunted feeling, I guess, that, like, I should write at a certain level always. And a blog is not like that. So it's like there's a little contradiction there. And I haven't been blogging very regularly of late, but that's, you know, I think it's okay. Even if I take a few months off, then post again, people seem to trickle back in at some point or another, which is nice.
Of late, you've been doing a lot, but one of the things that you have done, at least in terms of being able to share it with other people, because the way records work, you recorded this in 2011, but you've done a new recording out in mid-May from Nonesuch, of Ligeti Etudes, the Ligeti Etudes, two books, and a little piece by Beethoven, Opus 111.
Yes.
Always like the symmetry of that opus number.
Yes.
Among the many other wonderful things about it.
Yeah.
Tell us about the project. I mean, you also have a long set of both reflections and actual, quote-unquote, program notes in the booklet that comes, which is great, I think, and gives your personality to a reader, as well as giving insights into the pieces and the movements and sections of the Beethoven.
It's funny, I kind of sweated bullets over that program, more than most other things. I don't know why. I had trouble
really?
Cutting it. Well, there's a lot. I have a whole notebook full of observations or musings. Or
I was curious, do you write things down when they pop into your head?
Oh, yes.
Is that kept on the side of the piano or Velcro on your jeans?
I'm a little bit obsessive about moleskin notebooks.
Uh-huh.
I have like 500 of them. And
okay.
They're scattered around my apartment. Filled with all kinds of, you know, if I go to a restaurant or I'm just having coffee, I bring it and then bring it in the morning. I don't know.
Lined or the unlined?
I'm a lined moleskin man, although
okay.
I like the graph paper one too.
Okay.
And I have several of the music paper ones in case I feel.
Do you have?
It's a habit.
Do you own shares in the Moleskine enterprise?
I should be in Moleskine's Anonymous,
right.
Really. Yeah.
So you were sweating bullets. You were noting various things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a whole. I mean, I've thought of in the past about writing a whole book about 111 itself, and it's because mm-hmm. it is one of those pieces. It's like such an incredibly profound farewell to Beethoven, summation of his life, and it has so many, and there have been so many famous writers who have talked about it, and for that very reason that the piece it has so many meanings, and it seems to operate at the edge of the semiological possibilities of music. You know,
mm-hmm.
It seems to end.
And you note in the notes and even quote from Thomas Mann, although I guess it's Thomas Mann's narrator sharing
right.
these points with us, and Milan Kundera writing in a quote-unquote nonfiction vein.
Yeah.
I read the other month a long review in the New York Review of Books of Kundera's most recent book of essays, and it was the most dishonest, false thing I ever read. It never mentioned it was a book about music. He just skipped those chapters. He didn't even say, whoever
this
writer
was,
I'm not interested in this, but he reviewed it as if it was a book about the novel.
Uh-huh.
And it was mostly a book about music.
Oh, it was. Yeah,
Now, if you read that review, you might not know that.
Well, you know, a lot of people who aren't into music feel uncomfortable when the topic comes up because they feel out of their depth, which I can sympathize. I mean,
sure, but then why don't you say, I'm reviewing every other chapter? I mean, not you. Why didn't this gentleman do that?
Yeah, well, that's
probably Kundera's father was in Janáček's circle. I mean, he really has music in his
Kundera is he's a very smart thinker about music.
Yeah.
And what he has to say about 111 is very beautiful. And he says a lot of amazing things about Janáček in that book, The Testaments Betrayed.
Right.
That's a great book.
Right.
And there's great stuff about the way that we misrepresent, you know, these. The whole book's theme around the way sometimes in our reductive critiques or summations or analyses of these works of art, we betray the essence of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's basically the overriding theme, and the way that Janáček's work was misrepresented, or the way that And he goes on and on about how Beethoven basically chose to redefine form, the relationship between form and meaning in 111. You know, how just the two movements of that piece show that he's sort of he's tossing out the whole traditional behavior of a sonata, and he's making the form
behavior that he contributed to.
That, right? Yeah, and he did as
31 you know, other sonatas.
As greatly, you know, I mean, he wrote as so many wonderful four-movement, typical, right, and this is sort of semi-quote-unquote.
But he always had an interest in this two-movement, in breaking, I mean, every few sonatas he sort of breaks the form, right?
Well, there's the ones from the Opus 27 that are the fantasy-like ones, right, that sort of pass, and they're more like proto-Schumann in a certain way. The Moonlight Sonata, of course, very famously unusual, but and he'd been experimenting, obviously, with different forms. But 111 has a special place, I think, even right. among those.
Sure.
Because of the way the move, the first movement being 8 minutes and the second movement being twice as long, and the incredible radical juxtaposition of the two movements, this minor sort of time-obsessed, slightly neurotic and obsessive movement, and then this incredibly patient, endless unfolding of C major mm-hmm. after it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, for me, it's one of the most moving pieces ever. But it also has the great quality of being fascinating on so many literary or meaning, symbolic levels.
And in that it's also, well, all of those things, and it is this kind of summing up and this leave-taking
yes.
and this sort of going back. I think you talk about how not only does he, maybe you and Kundra talk about, not only does he write things that make the piece change, but they have an effect of kind of sweeping away what's come before.
Yeah,
and that's a marvel. And I hear that at least in the way you play the piece, at least on the recording. Now, in the New Yorker, of course, you were writing about making recordings.
I was, yeah,
and
with an emphasis on angst, I guess.
How much of this recording of the Beethoven is from one single presentation, and how much of it is from the chopping and cutting and reworking?
Uh-huh.
Or is that a trade secret?
No. I prefer to be open about that because I think, I mean, you know, you don't want people digging through it, but you know, a lot of the beginning, at least the first 6 or 7 minutes of the second movement are basically in one mm-hmm. take. There may have been one bumped note here or there that we mm-hmm. schmoogled in, but basically the flow.
Schmoogle
is a technical term, yes. Yeah, because that's very delicate. That kind of music, obviously, if you start putting in different takes, even though it sounds like it might work, somehow some subtle differences in mm-hmm. your vision of the piece on each take,
mm-hmm.
that kind of music is especially sensitive to it. And I would say 89% of the second movement is in one take, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. probably.
Would you ever see yourself as releasing a quote-unquote live recording or something?
Oh, yeah. Well, there are some. I have some CDs of performances, you know. The problem is if you say beforehand you're going to make a live recording,
right.
then all the pressure of recording sure. comes to bear on an already pressurized situation. So it's.
And then you look at what are released by orchestras, including our own Chicago Symphony Orchestra, as live recordings. Well, yes, they're all taken from 4 or 5 different live yeah. performances, but they're usually not. They're not broadcast recordings. And
yeah.
So with a piano, that's a lot. It's not so easy to say, well, here's 3 recitals I gave
yeah.
in different halls with different acoustics and I had a different temperature. That wouldn't
no,
work.
No, we don't have the infrastructure for
yeah.
that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's more complicated and it's expensive, of course, to do that. And there's all kinds of complications in making live recordings.
Mm-hmm.
But there are live recitals of mine and there are pieces on those recitals. You know, I'd be very happy to put out into the world with all their mistakes. Because I believe in them, you know. And
yeah.
there are some that I, of course, would rather were consigned to the dustbin of
yeah.
history in the most
right.
profound possible ways.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Jeremy Denk, D-E-N-K, who is pianist, writer, thinker, and host of Think Denk, also D-E-N-K, on the internet. We're speaking with him while he's in Chicago as a part of the Keys to the City Piano Festival at Orchestra Hall and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and its various enterprises and tentacles. One of the things you're doing in Chicago relates to something else that you're doing in Chicago, or that at least that Nick Pan is doing in Chicago, and that is this idea of collaboration, both from the collaborator and the collaboratee, or really who is the collaborator more or less than the other. But the point being, singers, string players, pianists coming together to make music, and you're going to have a program where it's sort of next.
Yes.
So tell us about these projects.
Well, it's an unusual program, and I'll admit that it wasn't my idea necessarily, but Manny contacted me about this.
Manny being a Manuel X.
Sorry, yes.
It's okay. We have delis in Chicago called Manny's too, so we just need to make it clear.
Manuel X, he was organizing this whole thing, and I have had a long history of being at Marlboro. I've played in the last 10 years quite a lot with Joshua Bell, and I've done a lot of work with singers. So I've sort of, slept around in various in one way or another. And he wanted me to put together this thing, basically, because the piano obviously is a great solo instrument and a great display vehicle, but one of the most important elements of the piano is its ability to support everything else, right? And it's an incredible literature, so we wanted to put together a program that would be all the range of that in one way or another. And that was difficult because you have to get different people into town, and it's an unusual kind of program to
We should say, so that means you're playing a song cycle with a singer.
Playing
a sonata with a violinist and a sonata with a cellist, yes?
No, we're doing the Dvorak F minor trio.
We're doing a trio then, right? So you're really taking almost all possible combinations, but many of them.
A lot of combinations. I'm sorry it didn't work out that the ballet, because there's it's true. There's a wonderful Balanchine choreography of Duo Concertant, which we're doing on the program, and we were hoping to add one more element of collaboration in there, but there were logistical estate problems. But it's like every possibility, and I think I tried to choose pieces that displayed, really interesting and important aspects of the way the piano interacts with other.
And, of course, Nick has been doing this, has set up a project that has launched in Chicago, though he doesn't live here, in trying to show more of this both on the singing side and the piano side. And maybe now you'll persuade him to put some stringed instruments in there, too.
But, I actually didn't know about Nick's project doing that when I asked.
Oh, when he signed on. Okay.
I know him through various people in New York, and I had heard him, and I thought, how wonderful it would be to
do. You should say his name is spelled P-H-A-N.
Right.
Though that's not how he pronounces it perhaps correctly, but it's not how you might think it's pronounced.
Right? Yeah.
So then you found out that he was doing this once you all were going to work together.
Yeah, which is great. And then there's a good Chicago welcoming element to that, to his presence here, and that's good because that keeps it in the family.
And the string players, are they, they're also young people, or the people you've worked with before, or the people who Manny assigned to you? Or
no, luckily, I have known Stefan Jakiv, who's very young, I don't know if 26 is young. It is, I think. and I knew him we met at a chamber music festival in Seattle, and I would say it's fair to say that we hit it off musically and personally. So I really wanted him to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. So that sort of started with that. And Katinka I went to Marlboro with back in late 90s.
Oh, okay.
We played together and hung out and had riotous, Marlboro evenings.
And somebody who's also made such an interesting career in that it's not that she's a former member of a full orchestra, which many soloists and chamber musicians are. She is a very active current member, was the first woman member of the cello section, and will have a second woman joining her this summer, but certainly is also extremely active with ICE International Contemporary Ensemble and all kinds of other projects and her own projects, and just has this great positive attitude, to use a contemporary cliche, but a true one. So that's neat that you all have the Marlboro connection.
It is nice, and we had just had our very first rehearsal yesterday, which was lovely. And you know, it's like someone that I met 10 years ago, someone that I met 2 years ago, and people, well, it's nice. It's nice to build these connections.
Let's go back to combinations of other kinds, and the CD, I think it's important for you, and I think it'd be important for the listeners, is not just Beethoven, which is plenty, but Ligeti, but also it's ordered to the extent that this will still matter. I mean, CDs have already become somewhat archaic, particularly for people younger than you, and certainly for people younger than I. I'm still playing vinyl LPs, although they are now playing those as well. But it's Ligeti, Beethoven, Ligeti, and there are a lot of reasons for that.
There are reasons for that, and that I like the order, the way that it worked out, which partly sort of enforces or suggests a kind of sandwiching the two works against each other and making them confront each other and kind of... I mean, I think it's pretty shocking when you listen to it and the end of the sixth Ligeti Etude is this crashing chromatic nightmare, and then it goes into this diminished seventh, very shocking diminished seventh opening of the last Beethoven sonata. And, you know, one of the consequences when I've done these sort of pieces like Beethoven... For a long time, I did Beethoven Hammerklavier and the Concord sonata next to each other. And people are often like, well, Beethoven was wilder than Charles Ives. Mm-hmm. And there's something, you know, there's something about that late Beethoven sonata that is more radical than probably anything ever will be, or as radical as anything ever will be.
I mean, he invented boogie-woogie and jazz in the early 1800s, right? Yeah. In one piece.
Yeah. But it's also I like the connection between the mania of the Ligeti Etudes, which are kind of unthinkably complex pieces, against the mania of the Beethoven. And I, you know, I have such an incredible love for Ligeti's music, and I think it has such integrity, on top of being beautiful and pianistic and mathematically fascinating and all these other things.
They're both composers, too, who pretty much know everything that's come before them, whether they've embraced it or rejected it. Yeah. But that's very important to them, right?
Yeah, they're both very much engaging in history. And I mean, Ligeti very clearly said that he was sort of summoning Schumann and some of the etudes and Debussy and others, and even Scarlatti. And he's very interested in these older keyboard models.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, I mean, Beethoven didn't have access to the things that Mendelssohn and others soon after did, but he already was interested in finding Bach manuscripts and things like that and wondering what they might tell him, not how he could correct them or anything.
No. I mean, Beethoven was obsessing about Bach by the time of 111, certainly before that, because there's in the intro to Last Movement of the Hammerklavier, Opus 106, Beethoven is writing all sorts of quotes from the Waldemar Klavier and assembling a sort of proto-Bach out of... So Beethoven's obviously by this point obsessed with legacy and history and trying to build something on top of it. And obviously Ligeti is on that path too.
Did you ever have a chance to meet or intersect with Ligeti?
Unfortunately, the closest I've gotten is working a little bit with Pierre Laurent Aimar, who I admire tremendously, and whose performances of these etudes are, known as definitive, because he also recorded them with the composer, and they're wonderful. But no, I never met Ligeti himself.
Yeah. You are at an age, though, where you are a go-it-your-own-way person anyway, and obviously you were from high school, probably elementary school on, but you do, I would guess, have the advantage of some of the various 20th century music wars being sort of behind you, and you can play Ives, and you can play Ligeti, and if you still also want to play Schoenberg or Stockhausen or Boulez, you can play those too. Mm-hmm. You don't have to make choice. I'm guessing that you don't feel bound to plant your flag in a certain camp or anything like that.
I haven't really, I mean, I try not to have flags or camps. I mean, there's music that I hate the, even in New York, I know all these young composers, and there are camps, and there are people who have differing compositional ideas of what music should be, and I, obviously that's going to happen. There are going to be these rivalries and also...
But people aren't in the positions of sort of being able to entire schools or labels or series banning entire other... I mean, they're ones that have preferences, but I mean, that's just sort of not around for you, I would imagine.
I don't feel the presence of anything like that.
Right.
Which is good. I mean, it used to be, I guess, you know, back in the day that there was a certain way of composing and that it was considered ridiculous to go back to tonality or to write certain kind of romantic music. And that struggle seems to be over in one way or another. But then there's also the problem of how the hell do you write? Right. Actually, you know, every style in the world is possible to you.
And what role does rigor, what role does quality play, and how do you determine that? I mean, it is problematic, isn't it?
I mean, it's very problematic. I mean, it's interesting. Ligeti didn't write very much music, right?
Right.
And certain kind of like harrowed and very self-judging composers, very perfectionist composers like the Ligeti, you know, they refused to put anything out that they didn't, you know. And I think it must be very difficult to be a composer these days, even though all options are open, perhaps because of that.
Maybe that's one of the reasons. We're speaking with Jeremy Dank, pianist and thinker and writer and observer. You work with Joshua Bell, and you've done that for some time. This is not meant to come off as anything negative about Josh, but certainly he's somebody whose repertoire interests are different, shall we say, from somebody who's doing a lot of contemporary work.
Mm-hmm.
And do you all just sort of work in a different set of grooves, or do you sometimes sneak a little Ligeti in between the pages of Tchaikovsky or Carigliano? Or...
But Josh, people have tried to convince me to try to convince Josh to play. I mean, Josh makes his decisions, and you know, he is drawn to a slightly what you might call, quote-unquote, more mainstream repertory approach.
And within that, perhaps romantic, capital R, to some extent.
Yes. We just played a recital of Mendelssohn, Grieg, and Franck, which is, you know, it's like just one romantic sauce on top of another, which I love doing. You know,
He's a great player.
I mean, and we have a great time playing together, and he is very inspiring, and he also respects that I, you know, have a different, you know, approach to programming recitals and different and kind of more wild, slightly less popular. But, you know, we each have our own kind of musical path.
So what are some of the things that you might specifically get or give when you and Josh are working together on, say, a program such as that?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question to answer in the sense that a lot of those things are intangible. I would say, as a general rule, Josh and I don't talk too much in rehearsal.
That's interesting to know. Yeah,
we do a lot of playing and a lot of listening, and then Josh will usually say sort of some general thing that is troubling him or making him happy or whatever. But it tends to be kind of more a process of listening. And I mean,
it's the Bernard Haitink approach to rehearsal. Play the entire piece through for 2.5 hours and then have the concert. Right? But I mean, get a sense musically of where you all are going.
Yeah. Well, I've known Josh for so long, and he's known me for so long, that we both know a lot about each other's habits, like family members. And like family members, we kind of know how to make adjustments to make everyone happy and to make the end result.
Are there things that you've taken away from that part of the repertoire and working with him that wind up having you rethink the way you might play some, quote, more unusual, unquote, pieces?
Yeah, maybe, I mean, yes. I try not to, and this may sound naive and kind of idiotic, but I actually try not to take too much of a different approach to Ligeti than I do to Chopin. In the sense of that I think still in the Ligeti etudes, certain good old-fashioned romantic piano virtues are very important, like beauty of color, sense of rubato or imagination about timing, transparency, you know. Maybe some of these things are more Debussy virtues, and each composer has the virtues that they need the most, right? So you have to kind of rebalance it. Josh has a tremendous understanding of what is required to pull a piece off in the public situation, how to keep the narrative thrilling, like certain kind of writers do, of keeping you turning the page from moment to moment. And I think that's something that I learned from Josh very much, that I love about his playing. And sometimes I have to almost, I almost learned the lesson too well. Right. And I have to, because I think my personality is a little more inclined to breathes more often than Josh is. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we have to find a middle ground in between those two ideals.
Yeah, I'm sorry if there's an intrusive aspect to these questions, but I think it's very helpful for listeners to music to have a sense of as many of the parts that go into making you all who you are, because we watch you and it's all magic and we know that you work hard, but there are these things that happen when people come together either because of different repertoire, different personalities, or complementary repertoire and personalities. We hear people all the time, and it's great, again, to hear so many younger people say, I love making chamber music. But one of the reasons they love it is the collaboration, which also has some tensions and some relearning, right?
Yes. I mean, it's Josh and I are very different musicians, and that is, I think...
Yeah, I noticed you haven't taken up golf yet, or I didn't see you with any video games.
We're very different people. We like to do very different things in our off time.
Right.
We're very much an odd couple in that sense. On the other hand, I think that's what helps to make... I think that tissue of dissent and difference is what helps to make our recitals interesting. I hope, anyway.
Yeah. You
know? I never have the feeling playing with Josh that there's like a... And I have had this with other musicians. There's kind of a war. Even if Josh and I differ, somehow we're able to make it work in an interesting way.
Yeah, I think. What's in the recording pipeline for you now?
Well, we're talking about the next Nonesuch project.
Mm-hmm. And this was your Nonesuch debut.
It was, right. Yeah, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a real thrill. The Goldbergs I had taken on tour last year, mm-hmm. so that is the sort of main thing on the table right now. We're sort of mulling it over before
you,
we
you've
come
done
in.
Recitals. I don't think in Chicago at this point, but you've done recitals where some would say the programming is a bit on the monster side. You might do Hammerklavier and Concord and the Goldbergs, and then all 32. Actually, Stuart Goodyear, who is in town doing the Faya now, Nights in the Garden of Spain.
Oh, I heard something about this.
Mervyn Maida wrote on my Facebook page that Stuart is doing all the Beethoven sonatas in one day next week in Toronto. I know he's done them all in 9 days, which is itself, but... If that's true, God help everybody.
In one day, he's doing them all.
If you bump into him,
I don't know how many hours that is. He's probably practicing. I haven't seen him, so obviously he's in some room, being a maniac. Yeah.
But do you think that there can be too much on a program?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, Concord and Hammerklavier. Let's say, take as an example, they're 240-minute sonatas. That's on the big side, but it's not the end of the world long, mm-hmm. right? The Ligeti and the Goldbergs is a little that I did last year.
Yeah.
That's something a little, that's just on the edge of being, and I would rather not do that program too much more in my life, because by the time you're done playing the Ligetis, you're so exhausted to play. I mean, it's. But on the other hand, those pieces really inform each other, and they're really interesting next to each other, and, it was really fun, and an audience, I think, the audiences were a particular kind of audience, because who else is going? What kind of freaks are going to come to a program like that? And they were, it was fun.
What?
Yeah, like what the hell? And so there is an appetite out there for, mm-hmm. but there is definitely. I wouldn't mind doing calmer, more mm-hmm. manageable recitals for a little while. Yeah.
And what are you looking to add to your repertoire right now?
I've been working up again since I haven't played it since I was. Twerp, the Paganini variations, which I have always kind of loved as the demon. I love when Brahms is allowing his inner demonic mm-hmm. side out. And mm-hmm. those pieces, I think often the Paganini variations have a slight tendency to become virtuoso vehicles, which of course they are, but they're also incredibly imaginative and harmonically, I mean, extremely fascinating pieces. And so I'm having a good time doing that, and some little list things. I mean, I'm one of those people who I love to find the gems among Liszt's potboilers, and I'm interested in playing. My old teacher in Bloomington, who was an amazing musician and guru, George Shebuck, who was mm-hmm. for many, many years there, he played Liszt in a very profound and beautiful way that made you realize, and so I sort of kept that in mind.
Oh, I think a lot of people are coming back to Liszt now.
Yeah, it's coming. It's coming. His stock is rising again.
Right. Yeah. By Liszt. another eventuality that enters into the lives of musicians And I mean, I've spent many a long dinner or late night drinking session with friends in the field, and it sometimes comes down to, you basically have a choice unless you're a totally solitary person. You're going to have a relationship with somebody who's a musician, or you're going to have a relationship with someone who's not a musician. And they each have, I imagine, tremendous advantages and disadvantages.
Right.
But you've made a life with another musician. I mean, does that work?
Oh, we're not together anymore now. So obviously,
not at all.
No, that's fine. I mean, it is a conundrum, and we parted very amicably. And
well, that's good.
And I don't know, you know, being. I'm not sure I'm a great person to ask about what one should do to have a successful
relationship. No, I'm not asking an advice question. I'm just saying it's something, though, that we forget that you all are humans and you need lives, too, and it's not easy.
Right. It's the way that the obsessiveness of the discipline intertwines itself, kind of grows into the rest of your life, mm-hmm. and becomes, it can't be uprooted from it.
And you add to that, especially since the now some time ago invention of jet travel, that you're totally having to be disciplined, focused, obsessive, and traveling all the time.
Yeah, the traveling is, I mean, that's obviously a big problem, although I'm a big believer that sometimes absence isn't wonderful.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's true, it's really hard to keep up even with friends, you know,
right.
Much less a romantic partner. And but it's hard to date a musician. I mean, I know a lot of musicians. I know how screwed up we can be.
Right.
And I know my own neuroses and the way that it, you know, when you have an important concert or a stressful event, the way that it clouds your judgment and your ability, your emotional
right.
perspective. And it's not easy.
Yeah.
And it morphs people. It changes
yeah.
you. And
I think there has to be some understanding of why it's important to the musician, for the either non-musician or non-professional musician. And then the musician also has to think about why somebody wouldn't be like this all the time. I think those are probably two challenges, no?
Yes. Yeah, no. I mean, inevitably, when I have dated non-musicians, there's one thing that they're very jealous of, is that you are so passionate about what you do,
mm-hmm.
that you love it
right.
so much that it's so
right.
what you do is... On the other hand, they don't always get to realize exactly how dangerous that
yeah.
that passionate connection is.
Right.
Yeah.
Ligeti actually could be seen, I mean, to come back in a way to what we were chatting briefly about with Milan Kundera, I mean, Ligeti really is a musician, a composer, who's, in a way, writing stories and novels, isn't he, in his music? I mean, there are lessons in there, not just harmonic lessons. There are tales and analogies that he gives to actors and clowns and
oh yes, there's some
tragic parts.
Yeah, that's an interesting. Yeah, invoking the Commedia dell'arte is probably an interesting. There's certain also like I hate to use this word; it sounds pretentious. Topoi of music that he's
expand on that for the non
topoi. I mean, topoi is like a recurring theme or a meme or mm-hmm. a thing. And so, for example, Ligeti got very obsessed with the descending chromatic
mm-hmm.
idea, which he called lamento, and he rewrote.
Can you hum it for us?
And he got almost kind of fetishized this idea, and took it. You know, which has always stood for kind of sadness, sorrow, tragedy, lament in Western
right.
music, and he kind of reanimates it in a kind of modern, super almost 21st century way.
Mm-hmm.
There's something I talk about in the notes about how that Ligeti takes these kind of romantic principles or older Western principles and then kind of merges them with the mind of the metronome, with
mm-hmm.
with the mechanical. Or the mathematical world that we live in, and with the sense of the machine and the, and I think for me one of the most affecting stories in the Etudes, and I don't know if this comes across in many, I hope that that's something that people get out of the performances when I do them, is that there's this sense of the conflict between the machine and some humanity that's trying to kind of. That sounds like a cliche, but
no, but
I think it's
in
there.
It's true, and I think they did the other day when there was the all day piano day here.
Mm-hmm.
You played the first book
I did.
Of the Etudes. And you have an audience that's come for a free day of music.
Yes.
That's featuring a lot of very big name pieces and popular things. And I was sitting there wondering what's going to happen. And a couple people got up, but a couple people out of 1,500 or whatever. And a lot of people I was watching sort of started off, I'm going to read the program now, I'm going to do the crossword. And then four etudes in, you had them and totally. And by the end, people were screaming like it was at a rock concert. And they were not only the eight people who had come only to hear the Ligeti, but so I think you pulled it off. So you should feel good.
I was relieved by, and I was amazed and impressed and flattered by the incredible quiet of the audience during
this. Total quiet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was actually the first time I had dared to play those from memory. So I had a whole second narrative in my head of, you know, hoping that nothing terrible went awry.
Right.
And I also had in my head thinking, you know, here's Chopin and Liszt in front of me, and then there's Chopin and Liszt or Rachmaninoff. There was all kinds of, like, good old-fashioned meat and potatoes romantic repertoire, and then here I'm hitting them over. But what? It seemed people listened.
I totally made the case that this was all a part of what this amazing instrument and the people who are drawn to it are about.
I'm glad. I think that was what Manny had in mind, was to sort of, you know, throw in a little, you know, the etude. I mean, many pianists and musicians consider these to be the greatest etudes written since probably Debussy or, you know, right? It's been a while since kind of such a canonized set of etudes. And
the other thing we have to mention in terms of Ligeti and his obsessions, of course, is the work that he never could get, but that followed him all the time, and that's Alice in Wonderland and his obsession with the book and with every little aspect of it, which, of course, you could spend a life with that book, and Martin Gardner annotated it, spent a life doing that, and other, but then his ex-student, Unsuk Chin, did write an opera, which I think is very good. But in a way, I think she felt obliged to write an Alice in Wonderland opera since he didn't, and she knew this was so important to him. Does any of that work come into any of the piano work?
I don't know, actually. Yeah. That's a good question. I wish I knew better. The sketches and the
you ever feel a white rabbit crawling up your arm during one
it's
of these?
That's such a tantalizing. I mean, it's like Verdi's King Lear or something, right? You know, Ligeti's Alice in Wonderland. What an amazing idea that is!
Yeah.
And it took a tremendous amount of work for him to get the Grand Macabre done, right? And it was very fraught with displeasure and cancellations. I think he was such a perfectionist that, because opera is always a thing where many parts have to come together, and by definition, not all of them are going to be as good as every other one.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
You have your orchestra, you have like 10 singers.
I'll see if I can find for you the interview we did with Unsuk, because she said it was one of the first times where she really talked about her relationship with him. I mean, they hated each other by the end and sort of divorced as student and teacher. And then she's come to feel that everything came from him, and she hopes that she somehow communicated that to him. They ran into each other accidentally once in Munich or something after they parted. It was very moving, but also it seemed to have a happy ending, at least in the sense that her music goes on and his music goes on, and she feels a connection to that music. But yeah, I mean, it is an ultimate thing for somebody who sweated over miniatures to want to do an opera of something that complex, let alone anything. And the Grand Macabre, which gets, what, one or two performances every couple of years and takes so much to realize it.
Yeah. I saw the one in New York, and I was blown away by it. But
the one that was done at the Philharmonic.
The Phil did, yeah. And, you know, it's
do you write music?
I don't. Between the playing the piano
that's
and
the one
and
thing,
that's the one thing. At least for the moment, thank
don't
God.
Don't go to a restaurant.
Don't
write music.
Don't put any ideas in my head.
Cadenzas?
Cadenzas, yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, I've become a very firm believer. I mean, I did, well, yeah, it depends on whether.
Stuart Goodyear's writing 30 cadenzas right now for his next 30 concertos, by the way.
Mozart always write a concerto, a cadenza for Mozart.
So you write one out and then you work on it and let it kind of freely fit in?
I try to improvise about 8 or 9 cadenzas, write down some key moments for myself, because I'm not like, you know, I can't keep these things in my head the way that probably Mozart could. But then I try to let it fly a little bit at the concert. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's... But I like that element of, you know,
when you're writing a, or working on or creating a Mozart cadenza, let's say, are you thinking, you know, WWMD, what would Mozart do? Or are you thinking, here's my response as Jeremy Dankin, the 21st century, whatever century we're in, to what he would do? Or is it that conscious?
That's a tough one. There are these great, cadenzas, famous ones, the Schnitke one for the Beethoven Concerto or mm-hmm. whatever, and there's that crazy guy who has his name I forget who did that, like, 9-minute mm-hmm. romp through all of music history in the middle of a Mozart violin concerto.
Right.
For me, those don't work because they are too transgressive. They just become mm-hmm. kind of a circus in
right.
the middle of as much as I admire the idea of it.
If you were doing a show or a presentation of that, but you as a pianist doing a recital, it doesn't make sense.
I find totally destroying the frame of the concerto around it is a slightly false answer.
That crosses a line.
I don't know. It should be fun, and I try to write cadenzas that mostly behave Mozartian, and then occasionally strip over the line. And then everyone always asks me, but it has happened to me that I've played Mozart's cadenzas, like for a 4-1-5, which I did in St. Louis last year. And those cadenzas are wonderfully naughty, and they're all that no one believed me. And I was like, you got to look, it's right here on the screen. That's Mozart himself. Yeah.
Well, Jeremy Dank, it's been a great pleasure and something I've been wanting to do for a long time. Just schedules haven't overlapped. Thanks so much for taking the time, and I certainly recommend all our listeners that not only you listen to Jeremy's playing, and there are the recordings out of the Ives and of the Ligeti Beethoven Sandwich, and yes. And then also...
Rejected title, by the way. The CD is.
Good, it's not an insult.
Yes.
and do visit Think Dank, because it will lead you, not only give you a chance to see what's on Jeremy's mind now, but it will lead you back and forth into a variety of things about music and about the life of a performer, and I would venture to say about life itself. So thanks
so
much.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Music we heard this evening from the new Nonesuch album, Jeremy Dank, Ligeti Beethoven. We opened the show with the first etude from the first book of piano etudes by Ligeti from the 1980s, Désordre, dedicated to Pierre Boulez. We then heard the first movement of just two movements, but long ones, from Beethoven's 32nd and last sonata, the C minor, opus 111. The album recorded in September at SUNY Purchase Recital Hall in Purchase, New York. We'd like to thank Jeremy Dank for taking the time to have this conversation with us, Maggie Berndt, Aaron Dennis, and Emmanuel Axe at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and 21C Media for helping us to arrange this interview. Thanks to Matt DeStefano, who recorded our interview in the green room in the basement of Orchestra Hall Symphony Center, and then edited and produced it to make it sound great. We thank our funders, as always, Alphawood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at rentap. That's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com, or hit the Chime In button on your screen at WFMT.com, where at WFMT.com/critical thinking, you can listen to the always free Critical Thinking podcast anytime, any place. To go out, we'll have the first etude from the second book of Ligeti's etudes, Galamb Borong, which we are told is nonsense Balinese. I'm Andrew Patner. See you next week.